Hey, moi, j'y vais. Je pense pas qu'il fonctionne contre les retards, ce vaccin-là.
La vaccination nous rapproche de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
The Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today, and we're going to start with some music. And we're going to go back to 1955 and the tune Blueberries by Georgia Gibbs, because blueberries are in season. I was recently at the St. Anne de Bellevue Market, and I bought some fresh blueberries from Quinn Farm, which were delicious. And I'm sure some of you out there are now getting local blueberries from various parts of Quebec. And so there's not too many songs out there about blueberries or that mention blueberries, but I found one, and it's from 1955. So this was actually a song written by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who were a songwriting duo, or they were songwriting partners and record producing partners that were the writers behind such hit songs as Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock, which were songs that, of course, Elvis Presley did. But other songs which they helped write with Benny E. King, like Stand By Me, or the tune Stuck in the Middle with You. So they wrote a lot of songs in their career, and one of them was this one called Blueberries, which Georgia Gibbs did in 1955. So here's that tune now.
Like this before. His lips were blue from eating blueberries, and mine were too from eating blueberries. Oh, what a luscious taste after a warm embrace. His kiss was sweeter than the blueberries. My head was reeling. Ooh, what a feeling. Never felt like this before. My eyes were seeing things they never saw before. My ears were hearing things they never heard before. My heart was sprouting wings, and I was flying high until he said goodbye. I left my heart out in the blueberries. Why did we part out in the blueberries? He said that he would be mine for eternity. He made me bluer than the blueberries. My head is reeling. Ooh, what a feeling. Never felt like this before.
That she would be mine for eternity. She made me bluer than the
blueberries. My head is reeling. Ooh, what a feeling. Never felt like this before.
Blueberries.
And that was Blueberries by Georgia Gibbs from 1955, a song written by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. Obviously, when it comes to the environment and the climate crisis, forest fires are pretty clear in front of our minds. There's a lot of forest fires going on in British Columbia and other parts of Western Canada. Yesterday in Montreal, there was a smog warning because of forest fires from northwestern Ontario and Manitoba, where smoke had blown in from there. So a number of cities are dealing with smog warnings because of smoke from forest fires, including Toronto. So I found a great talk from, it's a TED talk, with Paul Hesburgh. And Paul Hesburgh is a research landscape ecologist who works for the U.S. Forest Service. And he has a great analysis of why forest fires are so bad these days and what we can do to make them better. And this talk actually comes from 2017. So he was talking about how bad forest fires were becoming then, which I guess is about 5 years ago. And of course, they're even worse now. So here is that TED Talk now by Paul Hesburgh.
As you've probably noticed, in recent years, a lot of Western forests have burned in large and destructive wildfires. If you're like me, this Western landscape is actually why my family and I live here. And as a scientist and a father, I've become deeply concerned about what we're leaving behind for our kids and now my 5 grandkids. In the U.S., an area that's larger than the state of Oregon has burned in just the last 10 years. And tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed. Acres burned and homes destroyed have steadily increased over the last 3 decades. And individual fires that are bigger than 100,000 acres, they're actually on the rise. These are what we call megafires. Megafires are the result of the way we've managed this Western landscape over the last 150 years and a steadily warming climate. Much of the destruction that we are currently seeing could actually have been avoided. I've spent my entire career studying these Western landscapes, and the science is pretty clear. If we don't change a few of our fire management habits, we're going to lose many more of our beloved forests. Some won't recover in our lifetime, or my kids' lifetime. It's time we confront some tough truths about wildfires and come to understand that we need to learn to better live with them and change how they come to our forests, our homes, and our communities. So why is this happening? Well, that's what I want to talk to you about today. Well, the forests that we see today look nothing like the forests of 100 or 150 years ago. Thankfully, panoramic photos were taken in the 1930s from thousands of Western mountaintop lookouts, and they show a fair approximation of the forest that we inherited. The best word to describe these forests of old is patchy. The historical forest landscape was this constantly evolving patchwork of open and closed canopy forests of all ages, and there was so much evidence of fire. And most fires were pretty small by today's standards. And it's important to understand that this landscape was open with meadows and open canopy forests, and it was the grasses of the meadows and in the grassy understories of the open forests that many of the wildfires were carried. There were other forces at work, too, shaping this historical patchwork. For example, topography, whether a place faces north or south, or it's on a ridgetop or in a valley bottom. Elevation, how far up the mountain it is. And weather, whether a place gets a lot of snow and rain, sunlight and warmth. These things all worked together to shape the way the forest grew. And the way the forest grew shaped the way fire behaved on the landscape. There was crosstalk between the patterns and the processes. You can see that in dry forests, trees were open grown and fairly far apart. Fires were frequent here, and when they occurred, they weren't that severe. While further up the mountain, in the moist and the cold forests, trees were more densely grown and fires were less frequent. But when they occurred, they were quite a bit more severe. These different forest types, the environments they grew in, and fire severity, they all worked together to shape this historical patchwork. And there was so much power in this patchwork. It provided a natural mechanism to resist the spread of future fires across the landscape. Once a patch of forest burned, it helped to prevent the flow of fire across the landscape. A way to think about it is that the burned patches helped the rest of the forest to be forest. Let's add humans to the mix. For 10,000 years, Native Americans lived on this landscape, and they intentionally burned it a lot. They used fire to burn meadows and to thin certain forests so they could grow more food. They used fire to increase graze for the deer and the elk and the bison that they hunted. And most importantly, they figured out if they burned in the spring and the fall, they could avoid the out-of-control fires of summer. European settlement, it occurred much later, in the mid-1800s. And by the 1880s, livestock grazing was in high gear. And if you think about it, the cattle and the sheep, they ate the grasses, which had been the conveyor belt for the historical fires. And this prevented once frequent fires from thinning out trees and burning up dead wood. Later came roads and railroads, and they acted as potent fire breaks, interrupting further the flow of fire across this landscape. And then something happened which caused a sudden pivot in our society. In 1910, we had a huge wildfire. It was the size of the state of Connecticut. We called it the Big Burn. It stretched from eastern Washington to western Montana, and it burned in a few days 3 million acres, devoured several towns, and it killed 87 people. Most of them were firefighters. Because of the Big Burn, wildfire became public enemy number one, and this would shape the way that we would think about wildfire in our society for the next 100 years. Thereafter, the Forest Service, just 5 years young at the time, was tasked with the responsibility of putting out all wildfires on 193 million acres of public lands, and they took this responsibility very seriously. They developed this unequaled ability to put fires out, and they put out 95 to 98% of all fires every single year in the U.S. And from this point on, it was now fire suppression and not wildfires that would become a prime shaper of our forests. After World War II, timber harvesting got going in the West, and the logging removed the large and the old trees, and these were survivors of centuries of wildfires. And the forest filled in, thin-barked, fire-sensitive small trees filled in the gaps. And our forest became dense, with trees so layered and close together that they were touching each other. So fires were unintentionally blocked by roads and railroads. The cattle and sheep ate the grass. Then along comes fire suppression and logging, removing the big trees. And you know what happened? All these factors worked together to allow the forest to fill in, creating what I call the current epidemic of trees. Go figure. More trees than the landscape can support. So when you compare what forests looked like 100 years ago and today, the change is actually remarkable. Notice how the patchwork has filled in. Dry south slopes, they're now covered with trees. A patchwork that was once sculpted by mostly small and sort of medium-sized fires has filled in. After just 150 years, we have a dense carpet of forest, but there's more. Because trees are growing so close together, and because tree species, tree sizes, and ages are so similar across large areas, fires not only move easily from acre to acre, but now so do diseases and insect outbreaks, which are killing or reducing the vitality of really large sections of forest now. And after a century without fire, dead branches and downed trees on the forest floor, they're at powder keg levels. What's more, our summers are getting hotter, and they're getting drier, and they're getting windier. And the fire season is now 40 to 80 days longer each year. Because of this, climatologists are predicting that the area burned since 2000 will double or triple in the next three decades. And we're building houses in the middle of this. Two recently published studies tell us that more than 60% of all new housing starts are being built in this flammable and dangerous mess. So when we do get a fire, large areas can literally go up in smoke. So what do? We need to restore the power of the patchwork. We need to put the right kind of fire back into the system again. It's how we can resize the severity of many of our future fires. And the silver lining is that we have tools and we have know-how to do this. Let's look at some of the tools. We can use prescribed burning to intentionally thin out trees and burn up dead fuels. We do this to systematically reduce them and keep them reduced. And what is that going to do? It's going to create already burned patches on the landscape that will resist the flow of future fires. We can combine mechanical thinning with some of these treatments where it's appropriate to do so and capture some commercial value and perhaps underwrite some of these treatments, especially around urban areas. And the best news of all is that prescribed burning produces so much less smoke than wildfires do. It's not even close, but there's a hitch. Prescribed burning smoke is currently regulated under air quality rules as an avoidable nuisance. But wildfire smoke, it simply gets a pass. Makes sense, doesn't it? So you know what happens? We do far too little prescribed burning, and we continually eat smoke in the summers from megafires. We all need to work together to get this changed. And finally, there's managed wildfires. Instead of putting all the fires out, we need to put some of them back to work, thinning forests and reducing dead fuels. We can herd them around the landscape when it's appropriate to do so to help restore the power of the patchwork. And as you've probably figured out by now, this is actually a social problem. It's got ecological and climate explanations, but it's a social problem, and it'll take us humans to solve it. Public support for these tools is poor. Prescribed burning and managed wildfires are not well supported. We actually all simply want fires to magically go away and take that pesky smoke with them, don't we? But there is no future without lots of fire and lots of smoke. That option is actually not on the table. Until we, the owners of public lands, make it our high priority to do something about the current situation, we're going to experience continued losses to megafires. So it's up to us. We can spread this message to our lawmakers, folks who can help us manage our fires and our forests. If we're unsuccessful, where will you go to play when your favorite places are burned black? Where will you go to breathe deep and slow? Thank you.
And that was a TED Talk by Paul Hesburgh, who is a research landscape ecologist who works for the U.S. Forest Service. And he was giving his analysis as to why forest fires have gotten worse over the years and what we can do about it. So now we turn our attention to Democracy Now! Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Recently, well, it's been an ongoing series of protests and resistance to the Line 3, the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline, which of course is a Canadian pipeline, which is going through parts of the U.S. and meeting with a lot of opposition, especially from Indigenous groups. And the famous Indigenous leader and author Winona LaDuke was recently arrested at one of these protests. And she spoke to Amy Goodman after spending 3 nights in jail just recently last week. So here is that interview with Winona LaDuke.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at the ongoing resistance to construction of the Enbridge Line 3 tar sands pipeline in Minnesota along the Shell River, which the partially completed pipeline is set to cross in 5 places. Nearly 600 water protectors have been arrested during protests against the pipeline so far. On Monday, authorities arrested Indigenous leader Winona LaDuke and at least 6 others. She was just released from jail yesterday and joins us now after 3 nights in jail. She's executive director of Honor the Earth, her latest book, To Be a Water Protector, joining us for her home on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. Winona, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why were you arrested?
I was arrested because I wanted to stop Enbridge's Line 3 from crossing the Shell River. I've been appointed guardian at litem for the Shell River by my by the 1855 Treaty Commission and by my tribe. And Enbridge is trying to finish this line, and along with it's now 600 people have been arrested. But we stood there in front of the police for quite a while with our people and, you know, our horses and our children, and they arrested 7 of us.
Explain who owns Enbridge Line 3 and why you want it shut down.
Well, Enbridge Line 3 is owned by the Enbridge Corporation, the Canadian multinational that also owns the pipe under the Straits of Mackinac. And, you know, it's a really risky Canadian corporation, 225 subsidiaries with all the money kept in Canada, and they're shoving this pipeline down our throat. And about a month ago, the Minnesota DNR, which is probably the most corrupt agency in the state of Minnesota, allocated 5 billion gallons of water to Enbridge in the middle of a drought. They knew about the appropriation request in November. In December, they began studying it, and they didn't even notify the tribes until May. And then they issued the permit in June. 5 billion gallons in the worst drought in history. You know, our rivers are down 50%, 75%, and yet this pipeline is marching ahead in the middle of this drought. And, you know, ironically, you're looking here and, like, more and more money is being divested from the tar sands. I mean, the Saudi Sovereign Fund, you know, divested, like, $3 billion from the tar sands, and Chevron and New York Pension Fund and Royal Dutch Shell. They're all looking at doing this. It's like the last tar sands pipeline. And Enbridge wants to shove it down our throats, and our Anishinaabe people and water protectors have been standing strong. And you got to say, like, who wants to be have the last tar sands pipeline? It's the end of the party. But the Enbridge way seems to be to keep pushing ahead. I think it's called regulatory capture when they take over your regulatory system and your police. Because I think, as you know, Amy, the majority of the Enbridge has been required by law to pay for the police forces in northern Minnesota. Required to put in their pipeline. And, you know, one has to ask, if it was such a good idea, why do you need so many police?
But, let's talk about the police. The Intercept reported Thursday that Minnesota police expected the Line 3 pipeline to help boost their budget to fund new weapons. The article reveals that a few weeks before Line 3 was approved for construction, Aiken County Sheriff's Deputy Aaron Cook bought a new assault rifle that cost $725. In a November 2020 email, Cook wrote to the gun seller, quote, "Our budget took a hit last week, so that's all we'll be ordering for now. I'm hoping the pipeline will give us an extra boost next year's budget, which should make it easy for me to propose an upgrade trade to your rifles rather than a rebuild of our 8 Bushmasters," referencing another assault rifle. Your response, Winona?
That's exactly right. They've been bankrolling the northern police departments. Some of the police departments, like Aiken County, was saddened by COVID because they had to let people out of prison or out of jail there, and losing money on their budgets in that dysfunctional system. And so, you know, at this point, Enbridge has been financing all these northern police departments. And so you're seeing 40 different squads show up from counties throughout the state to repress water protectors who are just trying to protect the water in northern Minnesota and arrest, you know, hundreds of us. And, you know, it begins, it's a civil crisis when a Canadian multinational controls your police force. You know, I thought the police were supposed to work for the people and not for the Canadian multinational, but that's not what's happening up here. The Canadian multinational has taken our civil rights, clearly, myself among many being put in jail. I mean, that's the Enbridge way. Control the police of the states in Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, and shove your pipeline through. It's so wrong from every aspect.
Winona, talk about this related to the climate emergency. We're talking to you as there are some 80 massive wildfires burning something larger than the city of Los Angeles all through the West, Montana, Oregon, Washington, California. You've got Salt Lake, the Great Salt Lake, at its lowest level ever. You've got the fires rage, the in China, you've got this massive flooding in central China, which forced to evacuate hundreds of thousands of people. How does that relate to your arrest?
Well, Enbridge's Line 3 is the equivalent of adding 50 new coal-fired power plants. You don't get a tiara for putting this one in. And, so what's happening is that every day now you see the haze from the Canadian wildfires. We see our rivers are parched. But yet we see Enbridge and the DNR, Minnesota DNR, guarding hoses as they suck, millions of gallons of water out of our river to put in this Canadian tar sands pipeline in the worst disaster of a drought, and these massive fires that are to the north and west of us. It's really a devastating time for all of us as climate chaos descends upon us. And then yet you see Governor Walz decided to sell us all out, to sell out the Anishinaabe people and the people of Minnesota so he could get 23 jobs at the end of this. 23 jobs, from a Canadian multinational. It's really, it's so wrong. It's so wrong. And the Biden administration is just sitting by and watching it happen. I mean, I'm watching river after river get frack outs on them. In northern Minnesota, these are pristine river systems. I'm watching things get destroyed as Enbridge ravages through our country, and then I'm watching hundreds of people get arrested trying to protect our water and to stop the climate disaster that Enbridge's Line 3 represents. We're looking for more divestment in that. It's a $9 billion pipeline right now, the most expensive tar sands pipeline in the world. And as I said, that's like a great gamble at the end of the fossil fuel era, the most expensive tar sands pipeline in the world. And, it's brutal. It's brutal out here. I didn't like my 3 days in jail, but that's the Enbridge way.
Talk about what a frack out is, and have there been leaks?
This is a new pipeline project going in, but, they're crossing like 69 rivers and 22 of them with this thing called the HDD, which is a super phallic, horrible drill system, the high direction drill. Horizontal direction drill. And so what happens is that they're drilling like underneath the rivers and they hit an aquifer and they shoot out into, or they hit a beam, a seam that shoots out into the river in some spring that they didn't know about. And all of a sudden you got a bunch of like toxic bentonite, all kind of crazy stuff at the bottom of the river. And, the thing is like the Shell River is a pristine river crossed 5 times by Enbridge, hit by industrial agriculture like RDO Offutt. And it has the largest mussel population in the upper Mississippi River. It has this huge and beautiful mussel river, hence the name Shell River. And those guys don't last through frack outs, Just the, Army Corps of Engineers, the Department of Interior, all of these agencies are looking aside as Biden seems to, approve the tar sands pipeline. And,
That's interesting. You mentioned the Department of Interior because it's a Native American, first Native American secretary of the Department of Interior, Deb Haaland. She actually was at the protests in North Dakota against DAPL. About 200 major activists, celebrities, Democratic donors, and environmentalists sent a letter demanding that President Biden stop Enbridge's pipeline project like he did with Keystone XL and to firmly establish the principle, they said, that we will move forward toward real climate solutions. But the Biden administration has not done this. Has Deb Haaland weighed in? Not only not done this for Enbridge, but not done it for DAPL, where she was there protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yeah, sadly, Deb Haaland has not stepped up on this, and the Biden administration certainly has chained her to their position. It's tragic. There's no federal environmental impact statement on this project. It wouldn't pass a climate test. It's even bigger than Keystone. So if Keystone wouldn't pass a climate test, why would this pipeline pass a climate test, let alone the water impact? This is a fifth of the world's water. Enbridge is in the middle of, of the water wealth of our territory, you know, the heartland of the water. And the Army Corps of Engineers and Department of Interior, no agency has stepped up to protect the waters of the people of Minnesota, the Anishinaabe Trust Responsibility, nor, you know, any of the waters of this territory. And, you know, it's so disappointing that the Biden administration is throwing indigenous people under the bus, the water under the bus. You know, what, there's no new water, you know, and that everybody is tolerating more and more arrests as if, you know, that's how it goes these days. We just keep arresting people because, you know, we think our project's a great thing. You know, I'm so disappointed in the Biden administration, in Deb Haaland, you know, in every agency. I'm so disappointed that they are destroying our planet so a Canadian multinational can make a buck at the end of the tar sands.
Winona LaDuke, I want to thank you for being with us. Longtime Anishinaabe activist who's been organizing for years to block the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline, executive director of Honor the Earth, her latest book, To Be a Water Protector.
And that was A Democracy Now, covering the resistance to the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline in the U.S., where nearly 600 water protectors have been arrested during ongoing protests in Minnesota against the construction of this pipeline at the Shell River. And also from Democracy Now!, they recently spoke to Michael Mann, who is a leading climate scientist. And this was right after the big floods that were happening in Europe, especially in Germany, where many people died in those floods, where something like the amount of rain that would fall in 2 or 3 months fell in 2 days and just swelled various rivers there to the point where there were massive floods in highly populated areas. And of course, since then, there's been floods in China and floods in many other parts of the world. So there seems to be a lot going on in the world when it comes to climate change, extreme weather events. So this was an interview that was done a couple weeks back with Michael Mann, who is a leading climate scientist and the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. So here is that story now with Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As wildfires rage in California, we look now at the corporate profiteering off of those who've left their homes. We're going to do that in a moment, but we're going to first look at the catastrophic impact of the climate crisis around the world. The heaviest rainfall many European countries have seen in at least a century caused rivers to burst their banks, devastating the region. At least 110 people have died in massive floods in western Germany and Belgium. Most of the fatalities are in Germany, where some 1,300 people have also been reported missing. Floods reported in Luxembourg and the Netherlands, where thousands were told to evacuate Thursday. Germany's Vice Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, blamed the deadly floods on man-made climate change.
This is a natural disaster, but the fact that this natural disaster is taking place in this way is certainly connected to the fact that climate change is progressing at a speed that we have observed for a while. That must be another incentive and also an obligation for all those who have become victims here, for us to do everything we can to stop man-made climate change and prevent such disasters in this scale.
This comes as new research published in the journal Nature shows portions of the Amazon rainforest in South America now emit more carbon dioxide than they absorb, with deforestation, fires, and warming temperatures as the main factors. New data from the Brazilian government shows deforestation of the Amazon rainforest rose for a fourth straight month in June. Greenpeace campaigner Ramiro Batista said it's part of a disturbing trend under the far-right president Jair Bolsonaro.
Unfortunately, the month of June brought more bad news for the rainforest. After a century of fires, there was a record level of deforestation. There was over 1,062 square kilometers of destruction across the entire forest. This continues to happen because of the government's environmental policy and also because it's encouraged by the National Congress.
Meanwhile, another punishing heat wave is set to bring triple-digit temperatures to at least 17 million people in the United States and Canada this weekend, as a record wildfire season fueled by the climate crisis shows no sign of letting up. Over 1 million acres of the western U.S. and Canada are now in flames. For more, we're joined by Michael Mann, distinguished professor and director of the Earth Science Center, Penn State University. His new book is called The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Professor Mann, start off by talking about this catastrophe from the Northwest to the flash floods in Europe.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you. It's unfortunate what we're witnessing play out. This is what we climate scientists predicted decades ago. We said that if we don't stop burning fossil fuels and elevating the levels of carbon pollution in the atmosphere, and we continue to warm up the planet, we will see unprecedented heat waves and wildfires and floods and droughts and superstorms. And guess what? That's what we're seeing. And it's playing out in a profound way right now. I was impressed by the way it came up in this press conference, this joint press conference between Joe Biden and Angela Merkel yesterday, where she was talking about these unprecedented floods that are impacting Germany. And of course, Joe Biden is the president of a country that is witnessing unprecedented heat extremes and extreme weather events as well. And so the fact that we're in both of these countries right now are witnessing the devastating impacts of climate change really drove home the point that she made, that we have to act now. Dangerous climate change is here. Catastrophic climate change is here. And at this point, it's a matter of how bad we're willing to let it get.
So talk about the climate emergency and the absolute proof that you have. I mean, you were just part of a group of scientists who said there is absolutely no question here when we look at these fires in the Northwest, what's behind them.
Yeah, you know, there are sophisticated experiments that climate scientists do now where we call them attribution. And we can look like at an event like that heat dome out west, and we can run climate models, theoretical climate models, and we can do two different experiments. In one experiment, we pretend the Industrial Revolution didn't happen, and we keep those CO2 levels, those carbon dioxide levels, at pre-industrial levels. In the other simulation, we account for the increase in greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning from human activity. And we see how often those sorts of events happen in both cases, in this counterfactual case where we didn't warm the planet and in the real world where we did. And we can estimate how likely that event was before we warmed up the planet and how likely it is now. And what those estimates suggest, it was a 50,000-year event. You wouldn't expect to see an event like this once in 50,000 years in the absence of the warming of the planet. Here's the kicker. What they found is that you wouldn't expect to see this event even once in 1,000 years, given what the models say the impact of climate change has been. And we and other scientists have argued that's because the models actually aren't capturing some of the processes, like the way these weather systems become stalled as the jet stream slows down as a result of the warming of the planet. The models don't take that into account, so they're still underestimating the impact that we are having on these extreme weather events.
In other horrific climate news, Michael, a new research shows portions of the Amazon rainforest are now emitting more carbon dioxide than they absorb. Can you explain the significance of this and how this not only threatens the rainforest, but the planet?
Yeah, I can't overstate the significance of this. Look, we've relied upon the fact that there are these natural sinks in the climate system. The oceans take up some of the carbon dioxide. What we call the terrestrial biosphere, the rainforests of the world in particular, take up some of that carbon dioxide. And because of that, those carbon pollution levels haven't been rising as fast as they should have, given how much carbon pollution we're putting into the atmosphere. About half of that carbon pollution was being taken up by these natural carbon sinks. So the fact that some of these sinks are now turning into sources, not only aren't they absorbing CO2, taking it out of the atmosphere, they're actually adding CO2 to the atmosphere, is a real worry. And it reminds us that there are some surprises in store, and they're not pleasant surprises. This is one of them, and it suggests that we may see even higher levels of carbon pollution than most of the models have predicted. That's a problem. You know, our impact on the natural world, has led, fossil fuel burning, deforestation has this causal connection with the climate crisis. But we're also destroying critical ecosystems that are forcing these exotic species out of their normal range where they come into contact with human beings and you get these pandemics. And so so many of the problems we face today stem from the unsustainable way that we are, acting right now when it comes to this planet.
Which brings me to this Greenpeace expose. And, you know, Greenpeace recently tricking a lobbyist, a top lobbyist at ExxonMobil, into sharing secrets about the oil company's efforts to fight climate initiatives in Washington. The lobbyist, Keith McCoy, spoke candidly about his work, thinking he was speaking to a corporate headhunter. This is part of what he said.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science? Yes. Did we hide our science? Absolutely not. Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. But there's nothing illegal about that. We were looking out for our investments. We were looking out for our shareholders.
That's Exxon lobbyist Keith McCoy, who went on to tell Greenpeace that Exxon's support for carbon tax is a public relations ploy because such a tax will never be implemented. He also identified 11 U.S. senators seen as crucial to Exxon's lobbying efforts, including the key Democrat West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin.
Joe Manchin, I talk to his office every week, and he is the kingmaker on this because he's a Democrat from West Virginia, which is a very conservative state, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate.
So this is so key, Michael Mann. Some people might think Joe Biden's in charge. Others might think it's the other Joe. It's Joe Manchin. But the idea of what ExxonMobil is suggesting, having him in their pocket and what he's defending. Talk about the significance of this.
Yeah, it was sort of a Wizard of Oz moment there. We got a little bit of a peek behind that curtain. Pay no attention to the hundreds of millions of dollars the fossil fuel industry has been spending to pollute the public discourse on climate change. So what we got was a glimpse of what we knew was going on. It was an admission on the part of an ExxonMobil lobbyist of what we have known has been going on for decades, that rather than heeding what their own scientists had said, back in the early 1980s, there was an internal ExxonMobil report that called the potential impacts of climate change catastrophic. But ExxonMobil buried that report. They fired that research division and instead spent hundreds of millions of dollars in a massive disinformation campaign to discredit the very sort of science that their own scientists had had produced. And so it really does drive home the fact that there are bad actors involved in the new climate war. I talk about the tactics of these bad actors. And as climate change denial becomes impossible because of the impacts that we're now seeing play out in real time, you can't deny climate change is happening. So instead, they're resorting to all other sorts of tactics in their effort to slow this necessary transition away from fossil fuels. And, you know, getting a few Democratic senators to do their bidding for them has proven to be a very effective strategy of blocking action, because that's all they care about. They don't care about why we don't act on the climate crisis. They just want to make sure that we don't act on the climate crisis. And we have to make sure that they're not successful and that we hold our policymakers accountable.
Professor Mann, what do you think is the most important thing to take away from your book? What is your critical message here?
There is still time. Don't let the doomers convince you it's too late to do anything about climate change. That leads us down the same path of inaction as outright denial. And the inactivists, the forces of inaction, would love nothing more than for environmental progressives to remain on the sidelines because they're convinced it's too late to do anything. It isn't too late, but we have to act, and we have to act now.
Michael Mann, distinguished professor and director of the Earth System Science Center, Penn State University. His new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet.
And that was more coverage from Democracy Now! Related to the climate crisis. And you are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I hope you have enjoyed our show so far. And the coverage from Democracy Now! And, of course, the talk that we featured at the beginning of the show about forest fires. I know people in British Columbia, and many of them are starting to wonder whether or not British Columbia is all that safe of a place to live anymore, at least parts of it, because of these ongoing forest fires, these forest fires that get worse and worse every summer. And, of course, there are forest fires in Ontario right now, I believe in parts of Quebec as well, and in Manitoba. But yesterday, of course, we had all that smoke come into Montreal from forest fires in Ontario and Manitoba, compromising the air quality here. And, of course, we've already got intense heat and humidity. You know, otherwise, things are pretty good in the Montreal area in terms of there not being too much of a drought, because there's a major drought, of course, in California and in parts of, North America, sort of in the Midwest. Of course, here, farmers are thankful that we are getting regular rain, and there's a lot of local produce appearing in our local farmers markets. And as I said at the beginning of the show, local blueberries are becoming available as well. And so thanks so much for listening to Ecolibrium today. We're going to finish with some classical music, which we don't always do here on the show. But I also want to let you know that if you ever want to email us, you can email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUT Montreal. We also have a podcast called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast, which you can find on Spotify. And you can also go to the archives at ckut.ca to listen to past shows. You just click on the link to Programming and Archives and look for our show in the schedule, Ecolibrium, here every Tuesday between 11 a.m. and noon with your host, Ryan Young, myself. And we seek to provide the best environmental news and information that we can, from both a local, national, or even international perspective. So yes, we're going to finish with some classical music. There was a composer in the 19th century who was he was a Russian, and his name was Alexander Borodin. And he was actually a scientist. He was a chemist, and he did music sort of on the side. And he's famous for being part of the group of five that were dedicated at that time in the mid to late 1800s, to producing a uniquely Russian kind of classical music. And he's best known for his symphonies and a couple of string quartets, one of which we're going to hear now, and an opera called Prince Igor. And so the string quartet we're going to hear right now is called String Quartet No. 2 in D major. And this is performed by the Lucerne String Quartet. So thanks for listening to Ecolibrium, and have a great rest of the day.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Avec le concours Gagner à être vacciné, votre vaccination contre la COVID-19 pourrait vous rapporter gros. Chaque vendredi doux, un lot de 150 000 $ et deux bourses d'études de 10 000 $ sont à gagner. Et le 3 septembre, 16 bourses d'études de 20 000 $ et un gros lot d'$1 million seront tirés parmi les doubles vaccinés. Inscrivez-vous dès maintenant au concours Gagner à être vacciné au québec.ca/concours-vaccination. Plus vite vous êtes vacciné, plus vite vous pouvez participer. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
If you made a compensation claim for abuse at an Indian residential school, the records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized-owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of COVID and transmitting.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune into CKUT, always.
Guess who's coming to dinner? Natty Dreadlocks. Michael Rose. Guess who's coming to dinner? Natty Dreadlocks. When I'm in Montreal, I listen to CKUT 90.3, and it's always jamming.
And the rest Daniel and some brethren are calling.